Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter. Thank you for listening. I'm Andrew Fetter, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. And it's been a pretty extraordinary last week. I mean, I had some interesting events. I was just came back from Hopi Land, and it was extraordinary. But I do have a major announcement. And I plea for those people out there who have who can obtain firewood. Due to the unusual high level snow and Arctic conditions in Hopi Land, they're in dire need for firewood. Unfortunately, the government officials didn't think of that or anybody else, and so they're in a really bad situation. So if anybody can, or if you know somebody who can obtain firewood and whatever, ship it or somehow get it to Hopi Land. And Hopi Land, by the way, is situated off of Highway 40. It's just northeast of the northeastern area of Arizona. Please call this number. It is 928-734-6686. Again, that's 928-734-6686. 866, and they will direct you to them straight to the relief from where you can distribute the get the wood to and where. And like I said, please, if anybody out there, they have a real problem. We're, in fact, when I was out there, they were sandbagging and getting whatever they can because of the dire situation over there. So again, if you can, please help. I mean, it really mean a lot. And thank you. It was an extraordinary couple of days up there. We were only there for like several days, but it meant a lot because we met extraordinary people while we were up there. Old friends and then Wells new ones. And a whole other metamorphosis. I guess that's why a lot of people are drawn there. And of course we are doing our project and doing interviews and shots and met people and people playing, young kids playing their drums and doing chants and things like that and, talking about things, you'll hear within our, documentary that's, amazingly, eye-opening. Which I look forward to because we're still in the midst of doing that. We have a couple more interviews of some other Native Americans, and it's pretty close, but it's just been pretty amazing. And anyway, I know everybody's on their toes and heels here or whatever, vice versa. I do have a couple of known people wondering, what are my next shows? I have some very special guests lined up in the immediate future in February. As I had mentioned, a lot of listeners have been inquiring because I had talked about regressions, past lives, and whatnot. And I was fortunate, and I feel honored to have going to have on February 12th, and that's of course for the Valentine's Day. I'm going to have Joan Newcomb, who is author of A Tapestry of Time, and she of course will discuss past lives and how they interconnect with our soulmates. Well, it should be very interesting to anybody. and then on, I have another one, which I told you I was trying to get, and I finally, contacted him. I feel contact as he talks about contactees, of course. On February 19th, I am also honored to have author, investigator Nick Redfern, and, of course, he's author of Contactees, and that's, the author of Contactees, History of Alien-Human Interaction. And, of course, that's on my anniversary show, so that would be really extraordinary. Now, I have a special guest. It's pretty amazing. He has been pretty profound within the business community. He was a CEO of several corporations. He's pretty very brilliant. And went along the path of just focusing, I guess, so I remember back in the 80s we used to call them yuppies because everybody was sort of yuppie, get the beamer, move up, very just focused on the material things, make money, and that's all that was around us. You know, basically that's what everybody focused their energies on. And apparently he had, in recent years, have opened up to his spiritual side of taking a new path, and he's written an extraordinary book. It's written very uniquely. I've never seen anybody write in this full volume book in that way, which we'll discuss. And I welcome Mick Quinn. How are you doing, Mick?
I'm doing great, Andrew, and thank you very much for having me on and also for creating the space for learning.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I mean, every element, it seems like when you meet new people, everybody learns from one another. I had a teacher one time, he says it's sort of funny, there's the teacher usually learns a lot from the student and vice versa. So I guess everybody's teachers and students to one another. We always learn what you think you may know, then you don't know, as they say in Taoism, Tao Te Ching. But,
it's true.
I got a question for you. First, before I get into, of course, the matrix of all the parameters within your book and your thoughts and stuff, most of my guests will probably want to know, well, who is Mick Quinn? Because I did a little bit, the starting of it. You know, can you give us a little bit of your background and then you can take it from there as far as how you got into your discovery of your spirituality?
Sure, Andrew. I'm originally from Ireland, so I came to the States back in the 80s in pursuit of the at least what I interpreted as the American dream, and spent 7 years living illegally there in Boston and the area until I got a green card, and then I moved down to Manhattan. And long story short, I got involved in a tech startup that was that did pretty well.
So you're an illegal alien, huh?
7 years. An illegal one. Not an unidentified one.
Amigra. Okay. That's sort of funny. Okay, God, I didn't realize that. Because people assume they're only illegals are coming from Mexico or Latin America.
No, you know, in those days, from 84 to 86, you know, we used to hang out with all our friends at home. We used to go to this one pub on basically from a Thursday through Sunday, and all of the guys and the girls left in the space of 2 years. Now, you can imagine walking into a bar and you know 50 or 60 people. 2 years later, the bar's empty. They're all gone. They all left. They went to New York, Boston, Delaware, Chicago, London, Australia. Everyone left Ireland from like 1983 to about 87. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
So the only thing to do was stay home, be lonely, or, you know, and you hear all these stories coming back from the States, like how good it is and how great the country is and all the opportunities. And, you know, you pack a bag and take your $500 and that's it.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, so everybody was illegal in those days. It was no big deal.
And there was no potato famine either.
No, there was no, well, there was a famine in a way. It wasn't as bad as it was back in the 1840s, but it was really difficult to find, let's say, a sustainable career. You could find work. You could live at a very low level, but it isn't like it is now, or at least has been the last 10 years.
Wow. I didn't even realize that. So then when you came to, the U.S., what did you do from there on?
Well, after I got a green card, I was already studying meditation, and my meditation teacher suggested I move down to New York, go back to school. So I enrolled at Columbia to study computer systems, and I got involved with this startup that had some money, and we rented an office at the Towers in 1994, right after the first bombing. Because the price per square foot was real cheap, and we started this business, and it just grew in leaps and bounds. I mean, we worked hard, but it grew. So I did that startup, then we sold that after about 2.5 years, then I did another startup, then I sold that after a year and a half, and then I did another startup. So I did four in a row, basically, at the same time as I'm studying spirituality. So I had this, let me say, a twin life. You know, there was the Mick Quinn, who would go down to Wall Street and put on the suit and, you know, haggle over money all day. And then there was the other one who would, you know, sit and meditate and read the Bhagavad Gita and read the Dhammapada and The Art of War and all of these types of books and study Tantra in the evenings and the weekends. So I kind of had a double life for about 10 years.
Wow. What kind of business did you do?
We did software development and technical placement. So we do projects at, you know, Merrill Lynch, Bank of New York. Mostly internet stuff, because that was right before .com, the .com bubble burst.
Right. So then you would have been really just rushing through businesses, man. That must have been really hectic there. I mean, it was probably successful, but you're just probably working 24/7 doing that stuff.
I mean, you know, they say there's some saying about a New York minute. I mean, it's completely true. I remember bringing my mom over from Ireland, and we had an office at Rock Center right on 5th, and I took it for lunch, and I said, you have to be careful, Mom, when you step out the door, because people are moving. So it's like stepping into a stream that's moving really fast, so you kind of have to go at an angle and get in and stay with the flow, otherwise it's just going to walk over you. She couldn't believe it, like coming from Ireland was really slow pace. So, yeah, it was a pretty busy, you know, 7 years all told.
Hmm. So let me ask you, then you went from how did you allocate your time? So you allocated a certain amount of time doing your spirituality. What spirituality was in the very beginning that you said you were delving into? Like you said, you mentioned meditations. What kind of meditations did you do?
I did mostly based on Tibetan philosophy. My teacher had studied in China and Nepal, and we did a lot of Tibetan-based meditation practices for about, starting in 1991. So that was fundamentally the type of practice. That and also reading different philosophies, Hindu philosophy, again, Tibetan philosophy, Chinese philosophy, like reading a whole array of Eastern philosophies.
So you had very much influence of Buddhist influence, Tibetan Buddhist.
Very much. I mean, there was even a time when I used to call myself a Buddhist. I remember actually admitting that to myself. And, you know, having grown up as an Irish Catholic, it was quite a step.
Yeah, totally different direction.
Totally different direction. And at the same time, probably at the same level of development. I mean, I wasn't to realize that till later, but... So that was it for a number of years. So I had this twin life, and I think it was in 2001 where I was doing a lot of meditation, and I was on a retreat, a long-term meditation retreat in the south of France with a teacher called Andrew Cohen, who's based in Lenox, Massachusetts. And that's where I had my first awakening. And this was to kind of set me on the path of writing and teaching about this and finding a way to free myself from the, you know, as you said earlier there, the yuppie addiction.
So you moved from, and that was your transformation, saying, okay, basically saying, hey, I'm just walking away from my business side and just putting my focus on my spiritual path, basically.
Yeah, I would say, Andrew, that's what it looked like to the outside world, but from the inside view, there wasn't really much of a choice, and that was a very interesting perspective to have to deal with. Especially that, you know, I'd been building this particular, let's say, business image for the past, 17 years that I'd been in the States, and all of a sudden the whole world just falls down. And this happened 2 weeks before 9/11, so it was really kind of interesting coming back to New York and trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life, and then literally my business came down because I still had a presence at the towers.
So I'm curious, you know, what's fascinating about that is any of your business associates knew of your spirituality or did you relate with them on the side? Because, you know, you're, as much as you can try to keep a straight face, you know, talking software, do you think that ever transposed onto your working associates?
Not really. At the time, I and the group I was studying with, we like to believe that it did, but not really. And you know, I realized this after I got kind of tired starting businesses. I hired a coach, and one of the questions that he asked me, he said, what's your most important value, or what do you value most in life? And I couldn't really make up my mind, and as I studied with that question, two answers came. One was money, and all that entails, security, comfort, travel, etc. And the second was spiritual development. And it took me about 2 years to actually choose spirituality over money, to make spirituality or spiritual development, or let's say conscious evolution, my primary value. And it was only after that time that conversation became primary in all of my important relationships, because up to that point, I began to realize that you would sidestep it. Like, you wouldn't threaten a relationship because if it had a history of money or if it had some sort of security for that aspect of self, you really have to be careful with that. And I realized that this is all part of conditioning and cultural conditioning, and this is what I write about in the book, is how this can and was, in my own experience, operating without me even knowing about it.
Before I get into meat, or for vegans, the soy of the book.
That's good.
Yeah. It was really interesting because I was saying, I said it was, well, the way it was written is unique because I'm an author and I've read a lot of books over, but I've never seen a book that's written in almost written like a Q&A process, a question and answer, almost like an interview. And throughout your whole book, I was like, wow, this book is written almost like a Q&A, you know, a question and answer, like somebody's interviewing you at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what you have, like almost like, here's a question, there's you, there's a question, here's you. I don't know who's playing that. I guess the other person's playing the protagonist, and you're the same guy. It was unique. Why do you use that approach?
I think for two reasons, Andrew, and the first was just to make the reading simpler. There are many books out there on you know topics similar to this, and when I was reading those kinds of books myself, I would find out I would get lost in the middle of a long paragraph. So I said, how to break this up? And it was very difficult to break it up into short sentences and still be able to maintain consistency throughout the paragraphs and also the chapters. So that's where I came up with this idea of presenting. The P is actually for partner. And the second reason that I did it that way was it's not all Q&A. There's actually dialogue in there. And what I did was I was able to give my partner in the book a personality. And also, I was able to allow that voice, let's say, to evolve through the book. I mean, this is a comment I've gotten from a lot of people who've read the book, and they say, you know, I noticed that P actually gets wiser and smarter towards the end of the book, and that was also intentional. So it was for simplicity purposes, and also to kind of, you know, to put it simply, to entertain myself when I was writing it, because, as you can see, it's quite a hefty volume.
Yeah, well, it was pretty amazing because I've never seen me write a nonfiction in that circumstance. I mean, I do novels. I've seen novels done like that, but that was what was pretty unique about it. How did you obtain? And I know this is a real big, broad-stroking question here. How did you obtain the knowledge in order to elaborate within your book? How would you? You know, in simplistic terms, how would you say I have something that was told to me or I learned from it. What knowledge that you transformed and put into this book, or wisdom, I'd call it?
Okay, well, that is a broad question, and I think the most important message that I wanted to get across in the book is that we can deceive ourselves into believing that we're on a particular path that is eventually going to lead to the end of unnecessary psychological and emotional suffering. So we can deceive ourselves about that fact, and this is what I did to myself for quite a number of years. And so what I wanted to do with the book was, number one, to outline that. Number one, to explain the reasons why, because I can just make a statement and not back it up. And then to include in the book the tools that at least I and also my wife found that are available now that are really cutting edge tools when it comes to, let's say, the development of consciousness and also the development of culture. They include tools like meditation, of course. These are tried and tested tools, but there are several other processes and tools out there that are included in the book, and I'll just give you a quick summary of them. The first one's called Integral Theory by Ken Wilber. He's an American philosopher based in Denver. There's a process by a Western Zen master by the name of Genpo Roshi, who's based in Salt Lake. It's called Big Mind, Big Heart Process. It kind of combines Jung and Zen in a dialogue process, fascinating process for healing shadow. I also included some of the gentleness of, let's say, the Eckhart Tolle type teachings, the power of now, etc., and also the more direct teachings of the teacher I mentioned, Andrew Cohen. He teaches about evolutionary enlightenment. All of those wrapped up with practical exercises from the American coaching process, which is a fantastic process, and thrown in amongst that real life stories. So when you're reading the book, you're getting a blend of, let's say, bleeding-edge consciousness development work, very practical exercises, a dialogue process that helps you heal shadow, and also some real-life stories. You can actually say, well, what does this look like in real life?
Right.
So that was the general combination there.
Yeah. That's what I realized. That was in you gave how you merge into examples. That was done really quite well. I love that. That was the way you did that. Now I want to, because this is, I guess, the start. I guess the way you wrote it is like there's which is really cool is you create a foundation, and I guess the most important point for in the very beginning, I guess to give the tidbit For my listeners out there, you had mentioned the four insights. Can you elaborate on the four insights?
Sure. And, you know, it was interesting, Andrew. I had originally thought about writing the book with the four insights at the beginning. And as this book evolved, and literally it did evolve as I wrote it, they ended up being at the last four chapters. So the four insights, the first insight is called Renounce Conditioned Motives. And this is a chapter that speaks about all of the ways in which we act that's based upon the structure that everyone's familiar with in spiritual seeking, and it's called the ego. So it's based, all the ways in which we act is based on concealed conditioning. These are ways and things that we do, reasons for sustaining relationships that cause unnecessary suffering. So this chapter has a number of exercises in it that allow you to begin to identify where concealed conditioning or where the ego might be hiding out unknowingly to you through no fault of your own. Again, this is based on my own experience over the years of development. So that's the first insight. The second insight is called Reclaim Your Consciousness. Now, this chapter is based on what I mentioned earlier. Remember that question that the coach asked me? He said, what's the most important thing in your life? And I couldn't make up my mind between money and spiritual development. This is an exercise that allows the reader to look at the effect of conditioning, right? Individual conditioning and individual beliefs, and also cultural conditioning on their values, meaning on how you make choices. Because often when we come to major life choices, it can be very difficult to make a choice and, of course, to sustain a choice, etc. So this chapter is an exercise on looking at your values, what your values are, and also then re-engineering your existing values so that they allow you to make what I call awakened choices, which are choices that remove concealed conditioning from your life so you can sustain authentic joy. Again, full of easy examples and real-life stories. The third insight is all about meditation, and we already talked about that, how important it is. I speak here of a very simple practice of meditation called stillness meditation that allows you to sit and eventually, you know, witness the ego mind and eventually go beyond the mind for a while until you have to come back to real life. And the fourth insight is called Relate as Your Full Potential. This speaks about the power of awakened relationships, what happens when two people who have gone beyond ego come together, how that's possible, why it's necessary. I speak in here also about collective consciousness and flow, spontaneous right speech, spontaneous right action, all of these things that are forming part of what's happening in the world actually now. These are the structures behind this. And again, this might sound complicated, but I tried as best I could to keep it keep it simple. So these are the four insights, which are the last four chapters in the Uncommon Path.
Yeah, well, people make it more complicated than it is, and what you did is make it more simplified for what it is. Now, but the one question I do have, one other, is the utilization of ego versus self. I know, basically.
Go ahead.
Because it seems within the book, as I was reading it, it almost it seems like a better word, I guess, instead of saying a war of the between the soul, or better word, more of a struggle. It's almost like a schizophrenic situation, which in a way, it's sort of a situation with humanity. I mean, humanity is within its own illusion of schizophrenia, dealing with its own ego stuff, think it's separated, and then not realizing how everything's connected. So, in a sense, but how would you, the utilization of ego versus self with your higher soul or your consciousness is how you put it. Why is there such a separation between the two?
That's a great question, Andrew. And, you know, I think I spent, 8, 9, 10 years trying to figure out what is the ego. Like, when people say the ego, what exactly are they talking about? Every spiritual teacher has a different definition. If you speak to a therapist, they have a definition. So in my due diligence on the ego and in writing this book and also in spiritual seeking at the same time, what I realized, and this was something that I realized I had to put this in the book, was that there is a, let's call it an intellectual distinction that we have to make. And sometimes I get condemned for writing a spiritual book that has so many definitions in it, but, you know, we'll leave that as it is. The Freudian ego is the self-organizing principle of the psyche. Okay? Freud, whoever, actually never used the word ego, he said that in order to be a, let's say, a fully or a reasonably well-functioning human being, the I sense or the Freudian ego must be in good shape. So that's one definition of ego. Now, in the book, I put this with a capital E so that every time I'm speaking about the Freudian ego, that particular ego, it's capital E so people know what I'm talking about. So often you hear people speaking ego about ego and to each other, and it's like, which one are they talking about? Now, the other ego, would you put a small e, this is what we're seeking in our spiritual development.
Now, what, sorry to what interrupt I, you again.
Sorry, go ahead.
Now, you had, what's the difference between a large ego and a small ego again?
Okay, here's the difference. The large ego is the Freudian self-organizing principle. Okay, this just allows you to interact with the world without being someone like, what was that movie, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest? Okay, so you and I can have a conversation on the phone, and, you know, we can interact with the world and not be a crazy person. That's the Freudian ego, simply put. Now, the ego, the one we're after in our spiritual development, this is a mental concept that protects our sense of individuality. Okay, it protects the me sense. Now, I know I might be getting a little deep here, but just imagine this. Remember, let's go back 10,000 years ago. You and I are two cavemen, and we walk up to a lake, and we look in the lake. What do we see? We see two cavemen looking back at us, and we run away because we're frightened. We don't realize that that's me in the lake, because that concept had yet to appear at the level of human thought, right, 10,000 years ago. Now, between the period of, let's say, give or take, 4,500 BC to 1,500 BC, humanity as a race was beginning to conceptualize the idea of self. So when you look in your thoughts, you can see there's a me sense. You look in the mirror and you go, well, that's me. Shortly after the emergence of this individuality, there appeared another process which has now become known as the ego, to protect the sense of individuality. So this is the distinction I make in the book. Freudian ego helps me interact on a normal basis with people in everyday life. It's the self-organizing principle of the psyche. The ego, the small ego, small e, is this concept that protects my individuality. And it's really important that we can tell them apart and also tell which one that we're talking about when we're having a conversation. And again, I go into this in the book in the second chapter called The Whole I, and to explain this in more detail, and also with some stories so people can grasp it.
I love what you did there, because in my dealings, I talk about people how we're all connected, and basically, like, that's what the tree of life is. We're all like leaves. You know, it's not that we're all unconscious, because I told them, I elaborate how we're all basically one in the same, you know, connected so much as one conscious, one humanity, connected within there. Well, then we're just like, wouldn't that be like, we're being Borgs, basically, of the collective? And I said, no, there's also the element of our individuality, which... Really, I love how you explain that, is the small e is keeping we're all in one, morphed out this energy of one consciousness, though most seem to want to create an illusion to divide it, which even quantum physics now grasps that it is, we're all connected. But it also, the same token, we have this small e that you just elaborate of our individuality, which is makes us why we're the lead with our own unique little view, but we're all connected, which is really, I love how you separated that from the functional E, which people, I think, get lost in the big E, and they forget their, and they separate it, but that's out of twofold, which I want to get into some other aspects that... I didn't seem to elaborate in your book, but I want to delve into those. But like I said, your book seemed to be very tight line on a self-help guidance. But my question is, why did you feel to make it into a into this approach of your understanding, and as opposed to just go, I know, instead of going here's the rules, here's how it is.
Well, here's the good news about individuality, and the good news about the small e is that, let's say, the entire self-development movement for the past, let's give it 100 years, has been focused on developing this strengthening, this unique, separate sense of self, the personal self, the one with the history, the one with the fears and desires, right, that Buddha talks about. The problem also that's come along with that is that we've become somewhat transfixed or addicted to development at that level. So what I present in The Uncommon Past is what's called an evolutionary approach to self-development, where at some point we give up development for the sake of the small self, and we take on development for the sake of the big self, right? Capital S. So I am no longer developing myself for the sake of myself, my little individual personal with the birth date and the death date and all everything else that happens in between. I am now developing myself for the sake of humanity, for the sake of one. So this is one, again, it's another common thread that weaves throughout the book, is trying to impress upon the reader the potential that this holds. I see this, I'm not alone in this, but I see this as the next step in human consciousness, is that we begin to wake up to the fact that we've been very, very good at developing the small e, but now it's time to let go of that and move on to developing ourselves for the sake of others.
Okay. I was going to ask you something that's a little bit different, and I know you didn't touch up on it within your book. But you just sort of hint into it. What is your sense of the, because I know you're utilizing a way of healing within your book. What is your sense of medical versus esoteric, and within, whether it's alternative, example, Reiki, or whatever spiritual healings? What's your views upon, you would elaborate, because I know you sort of like subliminally, if you want to call it that, went into something within your book.
Well, that's a great question, Andrew, and you know what? This is why I bring in the work of Ken Wilber and his integral theory, and simply put, there are at least four essential dimensions of reality. And this is from Ken Wilber's four quadrants. And the first is the subjective experience. So that's what's going on between, you know, your ears and what's also going on between my ears. Now, at the same time, there's also an intersubjective context or intersubjective ground for our experience. That's the we space that we're creating together, which is just as important and just as relevant as the I experience. Now, when it comes to, let's say, traditional medicine, that falls in what Ken Wilber calls the third quadrant, which is the objective quadrant. Now, this is why often there's such a big clash between the scientists, the quantum physicists, and the mystics, because the mystics say it's all consciousness, and that's all that matters. The scientists say, well, it's all science and empirical knowledge, and that's all that matters. So both views are actually correct, but both views are partial, because all of these views are arising simultaneously. So if you and I, for experience, let's say we're looking at a rain dance, okay, there's going to be a subjective experience of that. There's going to be a we experience of that, if we're participating in that. There's also a cultural experience. There's also a social aspect to that. So there are four different ways in which we can view any particular opportunity or problem that we're facing in life. Each one of these four quadrants is correct. Each one is partial. So I bring in this concept of integral into the book, because I think it's essential to understand that your subjective experience is correct, but it's not complete.
Well, what it is like what I meant by one of my greatest teachers. She used, and in fact, so many people. She coined a couple phrases, which is amazing that people see it. Love and light, which she coined, and then also thoughts are things. And she said, used to say that when people change their tapes, which is the thought patterns, that will change their energy and their basically where their consciousness and their vibrational areas, how she put it. Mm-hmm. So if they focus, and it takes little baby steps, everybody's at their different paths. So it's changing your thought patterns and thinking your thinking. If you start visualizing and seeing, you're like a generator. Like what you're showing is basically changing the way people thoughts are. Thus, like Buddha would say, your thoughts are your which you're creating your own, creating the reality. So they're creating your own environment and creating their own situation. But it also comes more in tune for the reality of our universe is what you're doing is you're like, people are off the, you know, like the universe, I look at it as the universe has a certain rhythm, a heartbeat as the Native American for the earth. Things have a certain, like, vibrational area. And when you're not in tune or we're not in tune, then you hear this, like, you know, you ever hear, it's like going to a concert and you hear playing really nice, let's say classical music, and then you always hear one guy screeching his violin, and he's not even in the same rhythm. That's like humanity, basically, and therefore there becomes a disease, and then you go down to the level of the soul, and if the soul isn't, then what happens in that? And you know, it's different elements of disease. It becomes like a very cancerous situation, and then like what you're doing, which I think is just fantastic. Is giving a method, and I know there's, and I like it because you use the uncommon path, which there's multiple paths. All right, I meet so many people on my show in daily life, like everybody else. But you know, whether it's doing yoga or going to meditations or whatever your path is doing, or through a ritual, it's a way of what you matches to you. So this might, and I look at your book, it's very easy, because a lot of people, when they think of spirituality, they get all weirded out. They look foreign. Like if you tell somebody and they're not really physically fit, and you tell them to go do something, they're going to feel weird about doing some yoga. Or if you tell somebody let's do some meditations, or they feel weirded out about that because they're used to going to church to do prayer, and especially in Western society. Or if you tell something, even like from my Kabbalism and Taoism, and Native American spirituality, they're like, it's like foreign to them. It's like weird. It's almost like Wiccan or whatever, you know, or something. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're doing it in such a methodical way. If you were to tell somebody, hey, this is Buddhist, and the average person who has no clue of what Buddhism, they think it's praying to a statue, because that's what they're taught and that's what they're thinking. Instead of, I mean, the reality of your methodology, which is like small little layers. They're actually getting, I would say, teeny little crimps of Buddhism. But that's what I felt like. Like little, without knowing. That's the path. You're following the path without realizing you're going down that path, without being all, you know, weirded out by the preconceived ideas. That's what I just felt within your book. But I want to get into a real big question. I know I've been going into that, and that's why I was reading it to you. Is your Buddhist approach, in a way, as opposed to the Christian views? Because I know you mentioned in Christianity, and actually Orthodox Christianity is totally in separation of division, dividing things, and separating human soul and from the nature, as opposed to the unification of that within Buddhism, and unification that we're all one, that's the oneness, which is very commonality, as opposed to Christianity, which is a separation issue. How do you, and dealing with finite aspect perception, as opposed to Buddhism, which is looking at things in an infinite manner, how do you deal with that when the two opposites, I mean, it's not even close, I mean, they don't have any relationship. Probably the only closest thing is Jesus helping your fellow man. But but then I'm not going to get into the connotations of Christianity, how it's been changing, whatever, but the Christianity that's followed today is based on some separation, as opposed to unification, which is what Buddhism shows that path. And your book goes into the Buddhism, but then you throw Christian stuff, and I was like, whoa, that's sort of like opposite.
Well, you know, in our work, Andrew, we work with individuals and groups of people who are interested in going deeper into the message of the Uncommon Path, and we use this process called the Big Mind Process, which I mentioned earlier, and this is maybe it might at least in part answer your question. If we look at the human experience, there are two distinct aspects to it. There's the world of duality. Okay, there's the world of me and you and the subject-object relationship, right? I know I'm not the book in front of me. And I know that she's not me, and she knows that she's not me either. So we have the world of duality. Now, Buddha pointed us towards the world of non-duality, right? And actually even the experience of non-duality, where everything is one. Everything is emptiness or fullness, whichever school of Buddhism you ascribe to. The perspective of the fully functioning human being, right? The perspective of the human being who is awake enough to be able to serve others as a way of life includes both. Okay, it's called an apex view. So let's say we have duality on the left-hand side, the world of duality on the left-hand side of a triangle. We have the teachings of Buddha, the non-dual teachings, on the right-hand side. Both are correct. Both are true. The perspective that transcends and includes, or the perspective that goes beyond yet includes both, is the top of the triangle. So it's an apex position. So this is what they say, you know, to be in the world, but not of the world. To realize that you are a separate human being with a finite amount of time in this particular experience, at the same time as you are an infinite vehicle of consciousness, simultaneously, right? So now we're talking some serious paradox here. But what I try to do on the Uncommon Path is to show how this can actually be lived, right? So for the last, say, 5,000 years, since the emergence of the individuality, since this duality at the level of consciousness appeared, we've been living in a pretty dual way. And there have been some bright sparks along the way, let's say Jesus and Muhammad and Buddha and Lao Tzu and some of the great Zen teachers, Eckhart Tolle, some of Ramana Maharshi, some of the more contemporary teachers. But the dual way is not complete. The non-dual way is also incomplete. The apex is the position. And this is something, again, that I try to describe in the book as simply as I can without putting people asleep, is the apex position would be the fully functioning human being. It would be the perspective of a person who's capable of serving because they have both perspectives. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's does. I use, in fact, in my book coming out soon, everyone was asking about that, which talks about spirit. I don't use the word duality. See, I call it symbiotic relationship.
Okay.
That's all I read, because in reality, there's no duality in the world. There really isn't. It's actually a symbiotic relationship. So if you go into in all things, even though you may think they go separation because they do interact one way or form or another, therefore there is a symbiotic relationship. What goes plus, there's always for every action, there's a reaction. Therefore, it's symbiotic. Even if you look at the perspective of what's finite to what's infinite, that in reality it's a symbiotic relationship, just like they say in quantum physics, there's particle. So when looking at something finite and wave is totally, you know, non-finite in a way of looking at, but in reality, of course, we're finite's an illusion. There is no finite, in fact, in space and time. That's actually an illusion. In reality. Now I want to get into one other, I've got a lot of stuff I want to ask you, and I know we're coming to a head, and I know we went into, it's hard to gauge things, because you have so, you have so much stuff here, and it's sort of weird trying to, and I always like to build up things. I build up my own pyramid, that's how I usually like doing it myself, but, yeah. I do want to get in certain questions, I thought they're important. What's your view, you talk of ego and stuff, and do you believe in reincarnation first?
Well, again, another very interesting question. We could probably do a whole series of shows on reincarnation, but I would say that there's a significant amount of evidence out there to maybe not believe in that particular concept. I mean, I've done past life regressions myself, and I've had some profound past life, let me say flashes. I'm not sure I would even call them memories. But, again, there's a lot of evidence out there. There's some wonderful books written on that topic. So it's not something to be completely discarded. I'll put it that way.
So you do believe in reincarnation, correct?
Well, you know what? I don't want to put a stake in the sand.
Oh, okay, you're open mind about that. So the reason why I was bringing that up, because what I mean, in my belief system, I believe that you consistently, you know, regurgitate, you come back into your embodiment, and then and that's why the reason why I was asking that was because if you're talking the little E and the big E, because you carry your experiences back within you over and over time, and that's what you're trying to rehash out and refix. And then when you said Tibet, I know they believe in totally in a lot of reincarnation.
Oh, completely, yeah.
So I was just curious of that. And I do regressions myself. In fact, somebody I'm hitting next week, and somebody's asked me to do regressions for people. I've done that a lot of times. And then I'm going to London, and some people asked me to do that as well. But now, what's your view as first is the human soul versus the universe, in essence?
Well, my definition of the soul is the, let me say.
I'm sorry for using the word versus, by the way. I hate that.
That's okay. We're stuck with the limitation of the language here, Andrew. The definition of soul would be the felt personal connection to the Creator. So it's a very personal relationship or the aspect of self that maintains or is nourished by this personal relationship with whatever is believed to be one's creator at that particular level of development. So that would be soul.
See, that's really interesting. You use the word relationship. That's really, I can see it's the relationship with us and the universe, basically.
Right. And then the universe, of course, is that which we experience. When we meditate, I mean, you sit and go beyond the mind, and you know, if you're lucky, you'll have the witness will be witnessing emptiness or fullness, and if you're really lucky, it'll just be a non-dual experience. I mean, even think about this, Andrew. At nighttime, we fall asleep, we dream, right? That's the Buddhist, the subtle realm. We enter the dreamless state. Now we're not aware of the dreamless state, so technically speaking, we die every night. We're not conscious of that emptiness.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because actually in Judaism, in Kabbalism or Judea, which is the fundamental of it, that's what they say when you die. When you wake up, there's actually a prayer that very religious Jews do. They think that you're supposed to, once you open your eyes, you're supposed to thank God for you've now woken up, because you had just died. And then what you said goes in connotation with, I know in Taoist, and it's funny because the Native Americans said we were talking about that, that when you're at sleep state, they would say you're mixed up with the spirits of the world, meaning the other dimensions. In Judaism, they call it, that's what the unconscious Merkava is, dream state. That's the going to the other side. Mm-hmm. And in Taoism, it's going connecting to the beyond, the other side, to the reality of the beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting that how you use that as a mini death, which is sort of the same thing.
In the Tibetan Book of the Dead, they speak of those the subtle realms as the bardos.
Yeah.
These are the intermediate states between life, death, and rebirth.
Yeah, yeah, it's just fascinating because I see people say the same things, the same different ways, and they go, "Oh, this is my way." No, this is my way, but they're talking the same way. It's just sort of fun. I just sort of laugh. It's like if you're seeing a hill and everybody, they say it in a different word in their own language. They're calling it apple, you know, a mole, like I think it's in Italian or what I'm trying to learn, or whatever, or tapuach in Hebrew, or and Arabic, they always say the same thing different ways, and so it's like, you know, what are you fighting for? It's like salam, shalom, right?
Right. And we all sleep, right? So there's your common denominator right there.
Yeah. So what's your idea, though, of oneness? Because I know you show the uniqueness of our individuality, and then you also have, what's your idea of oneness, then, in your perspective?
What do you mean, the idea of oneness?
I think you utilize that. I mean, you inferred that.
Sorry. Okay. Well, you know, we can go back in time and say that, what is it, 13.9 billion years ago or 13.6 billion years ago, the universe burst forth from nothing. So when I mention oneness or the cosmos, it's that which existed before the Big Bang. Of course, it still exists. It's the context for the conversation here. It's the space from which the conversation is emerging. It's the space from which you and I are consciously co-creating the future, even in this conversation. I mean, you could imagine 10, 20 years ago, this conversation would never happen over radio airwaves. Look at it now. I mean, that there's proof of the evolution of consciousness. So that's the universe. It's the ground.
And then that's the oneness.
That's the oneness, and that's available to all of us. So again, we all experience that at nighttime, albeit unconsciously, when we're in deep dreamless sleep.
You know, and what's your idea of God to you? It's not like the man in the sky.
It's not the man in the sky. It used to be the man in the sky. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and my mom said, you know, there's a dude in the sky watching out. Be good.
Did you ever see the movie Invention of the Lie?
No, I didn't.
That's where I got that term from, because, well, he recalls it, and it's the man in the sky. It's a funny movie. They had to make up something why he's now lying, and he says, oh, there's a man in the sky, he told me. And he goes, oh, really? There is? But I can't lie. So they all believe him. And he says, yeah, you have to give me the bank was giving him money. Yes, because the man in the sky told me you have to give me $400 today. So they gave him the money. And
that's good.
So making a book about organized religion, you know.
That's good.
Yeah, so what is your perspective, though?
Well, I love Andrew Cohen's definition of God, and he says that God is the energy and intelligence that's co-creating the universe. And we're the partners.
All right.
It's pretty big, right? So the Uncommon Path shows you how to accept responsibility for that. Right, God incarnate. Can you imagine God with no arms and no legs? Right, it's pretty much useless. God is a cripple, can't do much. But if God realizes that he's got your hands, your eyes, Andrew's background, Andrew's, let's say, vision for the future, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. All right. And what is your view on what is the spirit and what is the soul?
Well, the soul we already addressed, and I would say that the spirit, probably you can just, you know, cross that over with universe. These are just different words that we use.
But attaining its individuality, but it's all collective of one consciousness, basically.
All at the same time. At the same time. That whole paradox again.
We're coming to a head, but last and foremost question, what do you achieve in your book, which is, I guess, the core thing.
What, Andrew? I didn't catch that word.
What do you want to achieve within your book?
What I want to achieve in my book is to get the message across to the largest, let's say, segment of culture, the most populous level of development right now, that there are tools to free one from unnecessary suffering available. They are available. They have been available for the last 30, 20, 10 years, and constantly evolving. So that unnecessary emotional and psychological suffering is completely, it's absolutely unnecessary, and that the tools are there. They do exist.
And how, Mick, how could somebody obtain your book?
Okay. The website is my name, which is Mick, M-I-C-K, Quinn, Q-U-I-N, GoodIRishName.com. Good Irish name. And the book is also on Amazon. It's been selling quite well since the release last year. And the website's got the details about the coaching, mentoring programs as well. So that's the best place to go, MickQuinn.com.
So everybody, I mean, this is an extraordinary book. This, when I looked at I've been reading it, glancing it for a few months, and then I started really getting into it last couple of weeks. And what's really great, what I like about your book, it's in a way, it's not a book that you read once, it's one you can go back to. It's written in almost like if you want to read about a certain situation or a certain area, it'd be a go back to book, you know, like, hey, you know, I'm this, wonder about this situation or what, how you feel about certain things. The way you wrote it was written, so that it's not, I read it, okay, I don't have to read anything else of it. It's a book that could stay with you, you know, not to, you don't have to put it back on Amazon and sell it, all right? it's a book that'll, I mean, it's very, and it's, it has, you know, life to it because it's something you're going to be consistently go back to, into. And, you know, I very much feel honored to have you on my show,
Thank
Mick.
You. Thank you, Andrew.
You know, adding any knowledge out there to, the, you know, thousands, millions, or whatever people who are listeners out there, and future listeners, a lot of people listen on the archives, I feel really appreciate the added knowledge, wisdom, and understanding
thank
that
you.
You've outlaid, and it's been a great honor, and thank you very much.
Thank you, and the best in your work with your documentary also. Good
thank
luck
you.
With all of that. It's a much needed, and we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, thank you, and I'd love to have you back on, and we'll keep in touch.
All right, Andrew.
Thank you very much. And with that, I want to reiterate on the relief for the Hopis right now. They are in dire need for firewood. So anybody out there, wherever you are within the United States, as far as obviously shipping concerns for us, obviously, if you know anybody even, maybe you can't, but you may know someone who has access to wood or shipping or whatever, please do contact the number. Again, I'll reiterate, I'll say it again, 928-734-6686. They do need firewood. It's extremely difficult up there. They're falling in degrees close to between 15 degrees at night, and they have absolutely no insulation in their houses they live in. So it's highly important, and you know, helping them if they can, it would be a need. So again, 928-734-6686, and please do help. Now I close out with one of my favorite groups, of course, Blind, which is incorporated in my intro song by Masonic Temple. They are indeed coming out. There was a delay, apparently, but they are indeed coming out. There was a little injury. Do check them out on Masonic Temple. You can also connect on them on there if you're on MySpace, MASTEM, and God bless you, and thank you all for listening until next week. God bless you all, and have a beautiful, blessed weekend. Thank you.
Eyes you can't see the way the world's turned. It's back a new long way from here. Open your mind, you cannot know the way the world has pushed. It's back a new long way from here. You cannot touch the way the world has moved itself on you long way from here. Open your heart, you cannot feel the way the world has pushed its luck on you long way from here. cannot see the way the world has turned. It's back on you, long way from here. Open your mind, you cannot know the way the world has pushed. It's back on you, long.